This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
With us today, Rabbi Dr. Mark Open. Those of you who have not heard of Mark beforehand, I will just share that he's one of the real founders of the world of religion and conflict resolution in general, and in specifically the founder of integrating Judaism with conflict resolution. He'll share a little bit more about his background. I want to take away some of the highlights, but I will just share on a personal note. It was reading one of Mark's books about 10, 12 years ago that changed my life, that set me on a course of rethinking why I study Jewish text, how I learned Gemara, how I learned Chumash, what am I doing here in Pardes, why am I investing my life in learning text, and think about how that impacts our practice. Practice as individuals, practice as what does it mean to build community, where are we heading as the state of Israel, and how does that relate to our neighbors. And so Mark has been a real mentor and now chavruta of mine. A lot of the programs that I run both at Pardes and around the world, outside of Pardes but through Pardes, are entirely inspired through certain ideas that he had mentioned several years ago. So it's a huge honor to have him back at Pardes. I think it's been a few years since we've been able to work it out. Mm-hmm. But I'm really happy that we have this opportunity.
Okay, so great. Thank you.
Okay. Well, it's nice to meet all of you. And maybe I'll just describe a little bit about myself. I don't have a watch anymore. I'll just keep the timing over here. Thank you. I got my iPhone. That's good. I don't know whether you saw the version of the book that was for today. They haven't seen it.
I don't think so. I think we put a picture of it in the,
oh, the picture
flyer,
of it. Okay.
But that's probably the extent of what people know.
Okay. There are a couple of ways to work at this, and I can work at it backward as well. This is actually my first and most recent book at the same time. I've written about five or six books, and I rewrote this one completely, and it was an earlier book called Healing the Heart of Conflict, 8 Crucial Steps to Making Peace with Yourself and with Others. And it was an effort to distill the work, very complicated work, that we've done for about 30 years. A lot of that work right here in Jerusalem and in Israel-Palestine. And we've been working at this for a long time. My PhD is actually in Jewish philosophy. I did my dissertation on Jewish ethics and Shmuel David Lutzato, a early 19th century figure who was a moral sense theorist. And there are 3 or 4 different schools of ethics and classical philosophy. There is moral sense theory. There's utilitarianism. There's deontological ethics, which focuses on Kant and principles. And then there's virtue ethics, that's more Aristotelian, and building of character. Each one of those different schools of philosophy, of ethics, have their counterparts in Jewish values, in rabbinic values. Okay, so there is an element to rabbinic Judaism that focuses very much on the building of the ethical character of the righteous person, which has a lot of resonance with Aristotelianism, which is why it was so important in the Rambam in his Hilchos Deos, as he formulated the ideal Jewish person. Deontology is a trickier relationship, but deontology is a focus on reason, on the use of principles that are universal. And for Kant, those principles had to be internalized, and they had to become from the internal conscience. But in a Jewish Orthodox context or a Jewish halachic context, it meant something that was commanded, but a feeling of commandment as well, following Rosenzweig. It had to be something internalized as law. There's another school that's not as well known that comes out of England and in France, of Shaftesbury and Hutchinson and others, that focuses on the moral sense. The moral sentiments are basically pro-social emotions, in particular compassion. Adam Smith, others focused on that. Lutzato felt, as the premier Bible scholar of his age, that actually chemla, chesed, rachamim were at the core of Judaism. and that as the core of Judaism, everything else in Judaism was designed to be a way to train yourself in those, in that feeling. Because that one of the principal problems we have as human beings is that we may have some very pro-social instincts, very wonderful instincts, but there are many things that drive us away from that compassion. You can, your first, Lutzado would always say, you know, your first reaction when you see somebody suffering on the street is to take care of them. There's an emotional attachment. What stops you? Oh, you turn him over and he's black. And you were taught to hate blacks. You know, or something like that. In other words, mental constructs get in the way, prejudices, hatreds, learned behaviors, and they stop your natural compassion. So for Lutzado, the key was, how do we take the best in human nature, the best of our Yetzer HaTov, if you want to do it that way, and make it into the premier characteristic of how we react? That's what his philosophy of mitzvot was. His philosophy of mitzvot was a habituation to bring out those sentiments and make them stronger than your antisocial sentiments. So that was how I started out, but world got much more complicated than that. In the middle of writing all this stuff, I came to Jerusalem the early 80s. I know that's a long time ago, before you were born. And in the early 80s, some pretty horrific things were happening already. The Lebanon War being the big one. It caused a huge crisis among a lot of enthusiastic Zionist people, religious Zionist people. They came out of the war very damaged, hurt by what they saw and also what they did. And it made them go through a lot of moral crises. And a lot of those people to this day, they teach in yeshiva, they teach in rabbinical schools, and they evolved a different approach to Judaism as a result of the terrible things that they witnessed or did in Lebanon. So I also was going through that. I was in the middle of smicha. I got my smicha from Yeshiva University. I was very close my whole life to Joseph Soloveitchik, first as a family friend, then as an assistant, and eventually his shamus. And our families go back to the 1930s together. But I was a little bit moving away from Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy and moving more towards Lutzado and others, very interested in Hermann Cohen. And actually for a lifetime I've been struggling with the rationalistic focus of Hermann Cohen and the ethics of reason versus the ethics of emotion and compassion. Because at various times I have seen the weight and the validity of one over the other. And so I've come to in most recent years, I've been very excited to learn that neuroscience with fMRIs and many other things, there's many other people looking into not the rational, not the constructs of philosophy, but the constructs of the brain, and discovering the way in which ethics and brain science are actually merging in very interesting ways. So one of the things that's coming out of all of those studies that have been collected is what I call compassionate reason. In other words, the highest evolution of human beings across many cultures is a combination of compassion and reason. That the brain at its highest is articulating empathy and compassion for others, and even higher than that is using that compassion to develop laws and rules. So why is compassion in and of itself not enough to make a decent person? Have you ever seen somebody who's intensely compassionate and commits great crimes? Do anybody know about anybody like that? You ever meet anybody that is very compassionate and has committed war crimes?
I don't know that particular example. I know in like Buddhist wisdom, there's this idea of like unwise compassion, and it's summed up by this analogy that like Buddhist teachers use of trying to save an animal, and by trying to save and touch the animal, they actually damage the animal. So that would be an example.
So that's good. That would require something more than just your compassion in order to save the animal, right? You would have to use something else, some other set of skills besides your compassion.
Yeah.
So your compassion would motivate you to help, but if it was just alone, you could actually hurt.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the basis of a lot of good medicine, too. And medicine, you know, medicine has a long tradition in Judaism. Pikuach nefesh is the highest mitzvah. It requires both a capacity to empathize with the patient, to listen, and at the same time to have enough skills to know how to save the patient, right? So there's something else involved. But I'm gonna, yes, please.
This is a very complicated and controversial case, but there was a case where there was an 11-year-old who had cancer, cancer with a 95% cure rate, and she was First Nations, and she wanted to stop taking chemo, and her parents wanted to allow her to stop taking chemo and resort to herbal medicine, and you know there's a lot to this case, but the judge ultimately ruled that she's allowed to, she can decline chemo and the hospital can't force her to take it.
Yeah. So, where do you see...
So there's compassion for the First Nations, for how First Nations people feel towards Europeans, European Canadians, towards the healthcare system, a lack of trust. There's compassion towards a girl who's 11 years old and doesn't understand the science and doesn't want this to be happening. There's compassion towards people who feel strongly about alternative medicine and think that, you know, chemo is really poisoning her. There's a lot of compassion but the girl died.
And reason might have said otherwise?
95% cure rate with chemo.
So reason might have said that your obligation primarily is to save the life, whether that person wants that therapy or not, right? Or your parents. So this is an interesting debate. And also, what is compassion? Is it compassion when somebody doesn't want it? Like, what about somebody who desperately wants to commit suicide, jump off the roof? At that moment, when you stop them from doing it, you're not being very compassionate to their exact wishes, right? So there's ways of debating what is compassionate, and there's ways of debating even what is reason and an applied principle. Yeah?
It's the same thing with folks with eating disorders, right? It's save their life because you can hospitalize somebody,
yeah,
or you tell somebody, but that person does not want to eat.
Exactly, yeah.
So we're talking about different needs. So some people, to have compassion for two people with conflicting needs, and the question is what to do with that. So I could, in stopping someone from jumping off a bridge, I could be having a ton of compassion on that person's parents and how they
exactly
must feel about it.
Exactly. So we're getting to an interesting point here as to why, in the end of the day, the human mind at its best works not just with compassion. Because if you just thought about compassion, you'd be shifted this way and shifted that way. What about this person? Oh, I'm compassionate. Oh, I'd rather go that way. And the emotions don't know what to do. Reason steps in and says, oh, what's the principle? What would I do? What would I want everybody to do in my situation? What would I want somebody to do for me? What would I want somebody to do if I was a parent? What's the rule? Can we come up with a rule? And that's basically why we are a civilization of rules of law. Okay? Rule of law is not just some sort of conservative construct. It turns out to be the highest evolution of human thinking, and that's what Kant looked forward to in terms of global civilization. You have to evolve more and more civilization so that in the last 200 years, every year, there are more international laws than there were before that year. So we are slowly, and Kant predicted this, that after we've tried as hard as we could to kill each other, that as time went on, we would see the impasse and the pointlessness of killing, like World War I, and we'd develop laws. Then we'd find ways to get around it, and we'd ruin that, and then we'd have to develop more laws. And he would say that despite ourselves, and he was a Hobbesian, people don't realize this, said despite that, we would eventually develop a system of international law. And that would be the ultimate service of the concept of duty, of an internalized notion of doing what's right based on a good will. This was his definition of Yetzirah Tov. He called it, the only reliable thing in the world is the good will, the will to do good. And how do you instill that? And how do you live by that? And ultimately, it had to do with the rule of law. Unfortunately, the world thought we could just make all these international laws, and then we were already evolved. But Kant understood better. He understood that if you don't constantly work at the internalization of the law to make it your will, to make you have a good will, a Yetzirah Tov in Hebrew, then you'll subvert the law. you'll find ways to destroy the law. You'll find ways to corrupt the law. You'll have all these laws, Bein Adam L'Chavero, and suddenly somebody will say, oh, yeah, we have all these halachas, Bein Adam L'Chavero, but it only applies to Jews. And...
Hello, Mindy.
Hi, Mindy. Somebody will come along... Please. Somebody will come along and say, Bein Adam L'Chavero only applies to Jews. Somebody else will say, no, it only applies to Re'acha B'Mitzvos. It only applies to other Jews in good standing. Ah, only good Jews in good standing, that means people who observe kashrus the way I do in Ger and not in Chabad. So suddenly, V'hafla Re'acha Kamocha becomes 200,000 people, or maybe 20,000 people, as opposed to 7.5 billion. And you've gone very quickly with the same text, and suddenly the text applies to about 20,000 people. How did that happen? Well, because you can interpret things any way you want. You can rationalize anything through the law, unless the law has become internalized in your heart. Unless you knew that the law was based on the fact that chesed v'rachamim and Asiyah Satov was in your nature, that that was what you were cultivating, in a way that Aristotle would say, or Maimonides would say. So that, basically, it's great to have compassion, it's the fundamental goal of Torah, and at the same time, it has to turn into law. And that law has to become not only something you establish in society, something you establish inside your heart. Okay? It has to be something that even in the rough places, like a crazy situation on a border, that you would apply it there too. And that's what we do in conflict resolution. We go to insane places, we go in between people that would make you crazy, and we still try to apply the laws of good and compassion. Yeah?
What do we do with, or how does that model work with laws that we might perceive as unjust or having a sort of a, or it's like programming in an inequality, if you will. If you like had a law, for example, that like mandated like you have to keep XYZ class of people poor, like, and then you sort of like you incorporate that into yourself because you're like you're taking these laws and you're like turning them into your own behavior and your emotions, and like that's differently problematic.
So Luzzatto, at least, and this is where I've gone with it too, and I think where neuroscience goes with this is that compassion is reciprocity, the golden rule, the ability to reciprocate with others, that empathy, is essential to the moral gesture. However, it can't be just that, because compassion left to itself leaves you very muddled and sometimes can make you quite murderous. And people didn't really give an example of that, but I'll give an example in a minute. And that is that it leads to the generalized laws, right? Then comes along a law like Bensura Mora. Do they know what Bensura Mora is? Bensura Mora is that if you're, you know, it says in the Torah, State and Pusuk, if your son refuses all orders and he's warned, you're supposed to stone him to death. Which rabbis came up with the idea, lo hoya velo nivra, that there never was such a son and there never will be? Well, somebody who was working and struggling with the fact that on the one hand, a firm belief that everyone is created in the image of God, a firm belief that the purpose of Abraham's mission is la'asos stucco mishpat, and then this strange warning about stoning your own son. And so they struggle with it. And they put conditions around Bensura Mora. Very, very severe conditions that make it almost impossible. So you see there the rabbinic mind struggling with general principles and specific laws in the same way that Ruth Bader Ginsburg does in the Supreme Court. People struggle. The law at its best is a real struggle between the rule of law and between basic notions of compassion and fundamental ethics. Okay? Now, this is a very important point. I would argue too that Nazism was compassion. Nazism was excessive compassion to Aryans. If you listen, you don't understand and you cannot have sympathy and understand fascism, communism, or any of these isms that killed millions of people unless you listen to the speeches and see the compassion there. Nazism was excessive compassion to Aryans. I will kill the world to save one Aryan. I've heard Jews say that too. Okay? Excessive compassion for one person as opposed to another leads to murder or even genocide. And the whole point of what the scientists have come up with in neuroscience, and I believe what the best ethical systems came up with, is that compassion needs rules. Compassion is great, but whatever you're doing for your child, you have to wish for all children. Whatever you do for your parents, you have to wish for all parents. If you cannot make that leap, you can't call this ethics. It's emotions, it's attachments, it's racism, it's all sorts of things, but you can't call it ethics until it rises to the level of laws that can, in principle, apply to all people. And that's where we struggle and we work with people in conflict analysis and resolution. We're deeply immersed in everyone's narrative, in their own private spaces of pain. You know, when I worked in Syria for 13 years, and I still work there till now, you know, there was the Sunni narrative, the Shia narrative, the Ismaili narrative, the communist narrative, the feminist narrative, the Protestant, the Catholic, the Ba'athist narrative, the Alawite narrative. And in all of that, you started to understand the complexity of what it would be to be compassionate and ethical in that situation. How would you pursue ethics in a police state when all of those people are together? How would you keep them from killing each other? How would you build peace? That's where empathy and reason try to work together. Yeah?
Would it then be unethical if, let's say, somebody has a sibling who's in dire straits, and they give up half their salary to support their sibling and all of their children? Because they do so, they can't give to others. They don't have the money to give to others aside from their sibling and their family. So that'd be unethical because that's like favoritism by, you know, like, you're my tribe, you're my blood, I'm giving to you, and that detracts from my ability to give to others.
Yeah. So the great philosophers and scholars, it's a mark of a good ethicist and in history, in many religions and wisdom traditions, to acknowledge that obscurity, to acknowledge that ambivalence. I mean, for Luzzatto, Luzzatto tried to evolve a graduated system of ethics. He identified about 7 laws, he claimed, including interest-free loans, that he said were a kind of special extra love for my people. So the idea of an interest-free loan or loan forgiveness, he said, business runs on loans, it runs on some interest, but there's a special act of love that I do for fellow Jews. However, there are universal principles that prevent any kind of lying, any kind of stealing, any kind of injustice to my non-Jewish neighbors. And charity, he insisted charity was both a Jewish idea and a non-Jewish idea, and he had his texts to prove it. But he would argue that there's a place for it, and Plato and Aristotle and others argued about this, because in a certain sense, a radical notion of no preference for family has led to certain very radical ideas that ended up making cruelty, like the radical communist ideas, no affiliation to family, monarchs got to be killed, they're by definition evil, and all of that leads to a great deal of, in the end, of killing. So it's a funny way in which compassion, when it's out of control, can lead to a great deal of unhappiness and even violence. Whereas compassion, together working with reason, compassionate reason, seems to move in a better direction. So I just want to say that I evolved out of that and out of these extremely difficult decisions that I was doing with other peacemakers, with Rev Froman, with...
I don't think they know Rabbi Froman.
What?
I'm not sure people know.
Oh, I was working with settlers who were working on peace with Palestinians, and that was unheard of in the 1980s. And I moved towards them because I looked at the complexity of the narrative, and I said, you know, I looked at a settler who was doing incredible work with his Palestinian neighbors, and I said, you know, he's there with compassion. He's reaching out and building a relationship, but a lot of other people are saying the right political things, but they're not working on any kind of compassion. They just want to vote the right way. And I said, okay, voting for law, because voting is about the law. Voting is about which laws you prefer, which treaties you prefer. But compassion is a much more relational, direct thing to another person. And I realized that on a certain level, the people who were on the ground were actually engaged and struggling with what it would be to live together and what it would be to love somebody who was an enemy. And I saw all these people loving each other who were enemies. I said, this is interesting. This is impressive. And a lot of people who were talking peace were not building any of those relationships. And in fact, they hated a whole bunch of people. They certainly hated religious people. They hated extremists. They hated everybody, except they wanted to vote the right way about peace. And I said, that's not quite enough in ethical systems. That actually doesn't lead to what I call in my books increments of positive change. So I started focusing my conflict resolution practice a lot more on what you would have called Musar, or what you would have called Halachos Bein Adam L'Chaveru, or the kind of monastic disciplines of piety, like Shmirat HaLashon. You know what Shmirat HaLashon is? Okay, the watching of every word. It turns out that the ability to control yourself at every moment for what word you use and don't use is critical to authentic conflict resolution. It turns out that using a positive word as opposed to a negative word at every moment can be the difference between whether you're kicked out of a police state or whether you influence hearts and minds in a police state. And I had to discipline myself every single year when I was on television in Syria, watching every single word I said and saying, what kind of impact does this have? And it took me right back to Halachos of the Chafetz Chaim. So it turns out that appreciative inquiry, have you heard of appreciative inquiry? Appreciative inquiry and positive psychology, you know, meet the Chafetz Chaim. And that's the chapter on the use of every word. Because personal piety, whether you're a religious person or a secular person, the ability to work on your mind and your heart, the ability to be humble enough to see your mistakes every single day, which sounds like a very monastic kind of thing to do, turns out to be critical to the difference between successful peacemakers and failed peacemakers. People who actually reach the hearts of others who are their enemies and those who completely fail. It is in that moment, daily, even this year, my practice this year is 10 times better than it was in the last 20, 30 years. And I've been trying to figure out why this time I had a deep relationship with one of the leaders of the settler peace movement, a deep breakthrough with Hasidim, and I just continually deepen my relationship with Palestinian students who are I'm their mentor. So why did that all happen in 1 year? And why didn't I fall apart emotionally? I usually, when I'm in the Haitian refugee camp, I'm a wreck, and then I go and I work with settlers, and I'm boiling, and I'm angry, you know. And I didn't have any of that this year, as bad as the situation is. And I realized the difference was meditation. Now, meditation is not, you know, religious practice for me, but it turned out that it cleared my mind enough and allowed me bechinas hanefesh, self-examination, in a way that no other practice had. Simple breathing and concentration. And it released from me this assault of fears and negative emotions and anger and rage, and so that I could concentrate on the person in front of me. So all of this is stuff that is deep in Jewish tradition. It's also deep in Sufi tradition. It's deep in Tibetan Buddhist tradition. There's many traditions that have wisdom. The Epicurean tradition in ancient Greece, so many great wisdom traditions worked on the soul, worked on the reactions to the world. And I would argue that that is the first and last place that we should begin with all of this political talk that everybody does. I'm very impressed with how far people get who don't have anger when they speak, and very unimpressed with those who scream about peace. I met with a wonderful new voice in Parliament, Ayman O'Day, fascinating, humble, interesting Palestinian Israeli, and he's getting so much farther than so many others that got up there at the dais and just shouted and shouted and shouted. There are people shouting right wing, shouting left wing, and so on. So that's a kind of practice, and a very short summary. These 8 steps, I would love you to take a look at it. There's a lot online that you can look at if you don't want to buy it. Look at these steps in terms of knowing that each one of them came out of Jewish tradition, but also out of neuroscience and psychology, and start testing yourself, seeing how you are based on trying to operate with some of these principles. So now I'll open it up to some discussion. Yes?
So I'm just wondering how...
Just tell me your name.
I'm Shoshana.
Shoshana.
Yeah, I'm wondering how we reconcile some of the very particularist tendencies within Judaism with this kind of worldview, which instinctively I'm more sympathetic to, but then of course we have all of our tradition that does kind of set up a Jews versus all of the rest of the world set up.
So there are very competing voices within tradition, and people have been in different moods in history. A lot of the texts come from such dark times. So there's parts of the prayer book that are, you know, Avarachamim right in the middle of the Crusades. I'm not thrilled that it's all thrown together like a cholent, but that's what it is. And so suddenly you're ecstatic with Yoach Sof, and then suddenly you're in the dirt with Avarachamim. And I don't really get it. I probably wouldn't do it this way. I've started to notice. I was just with Hasidim for the entire weekend, and people say maybe a tenth of what's in the Siddur. You know, it's like people skip everything. So the difference between the Orthodox and Reform is the Reform just take everything out that they don't want. But the Orthodox say it, keep it in there, but they say about one tenth of it. You know, it's like I watched everybody. I was trying to catch how much could they say. And they usually say about, you know, about 2 sentences out of 30. And then we were on to the next. But that's an interesting kind of interpretation. People... You see this in many religious traditions. So what I'm trying to say is this, that our focus is the key. That's why one of the steps here is focusing on vision, imagination, and the future. So like, for example, after you've done a lot of cheshbon nefesh, build a peaceful identity and character, after you've looked at your emotions and made them part of healing, after you've done some study of conflict analysis and resolution, neuroscience, then you listen, then you observe everything, and your first step of building something is build visions of your future without conflict. In other words, the brain, when you go in the past, is very dark. So much that you're dealing with, so much everybody deals with. And so a way of turning things around is looking where in Torah, where in Chazal, are they talking about the past, and where are they building the future? And that you'll start to see, and same thing in the Nevi'im. The Nevi'im talk about the present, there's so much anger. And when they talk about the future, there's unbelievable beauty, unbelievable vision. And I think that we have the right to emphasize what we want to. Even within Orthodox Judaism, you have the right to emphasize what you want to. You still, you know, it's a practice-based tradition. There's a mitzvah d'oraisa to pray every day. But it's all the Rabbanans, what you do with that, you know? But it's a mitzvah to have that moment, whatever that is. But then there is the construction of your present, of your future, of your vision. And the brain changes completely. Like if you're ever in a room with people screaming at each other, or they're screaming about politics, ask them, what do they want to do? And they'll say, I don't know. And when the brain says, I don't know, it means the neocortex is stuck. Because until that moment, they were totally enslaved to the amygdala. The amygdala knew what was the danger. It was screaming and shouting and using clever verses, but it's just firing off fear. The moment you ask about the future, the brain has to work much, much harder on thinking, what could be? What should be? And I think that we can shift. I mean, to sit with these Hasidim on Saturday, who I thought, I mean, they said the politicians don't know what they're doing. I said, what are you talking about? I said, I have hundreds of Arab neighbors who I'm in business with. This is in the north, in the Galil. So we get along fine. He's big, the kapata and the big hat, and he's sitting there telling me he has all of these Arab business partners. He says, they don't know how to do it. We know how to do it. And then they all started. I said, but yeah, but I met your Rebbe, and he's, oh, my, our Rebbe is right wing. So it blew my mind. It's like, right, wait a second, I thought you were robots and you're supposed to, you know, so no. So, you know, I looked at the black coat. I totally misjudged the black coat. I totally misjudged. Here was a person who was evolved, thinking, experimenting, and he was still vigorously Shomer mitzvos that you and I don't even understand. The levels of details that they are, you know, that they're doing. Because there is freedom within all of these ritual practices of how you evolve your mind. Yeah.
Couple questions.
And then?
The first is where you see...
What's your name?
My name is Jonah. I was wondering where you see us, just like the average person, in the role of creation of law, both secular and Jewish law. If we're looking at laws like formalized compassion, or, I don't know, maybe that's not the best conclusion, you have a better one, but... Where are we in that process? What role do we play?
Yeah.
And secondly, sort of unrelated, I just had the pleasure last year of reading Marshall Rosenberg's Nonviolent Communication, and it had a very profound effect on me. And I was wondering if you're familiar with that text or that theory
of course.
Communication and whether it played a role in your research and your work.
No, it didn't. He's a fellow traveler, and we both got it from the same place. But yes, wonderful man, and he's done wonderful things by making a methodology and getting it to be taught in by so many thousands of people. That's his accomplishment. But nonviolent communication is, again, it's Chafetz Chaim. In fact, even more so. So this it's the tip of the iceberg of how deep piety can go in terms of the care with which each word changes history, sometimes on a Kabbalistic way, sometimes in a more... Litvak way, but with the same idea of what is nonviolent communication. So yes, it's very helpful, but we have a gold mine here. The question is why it's not used. Why is it dusty? Why, in fact, sometimes is it scoffed at? I'll never forget a turning point in my life. I'm 26 years old. I was a rabbi for a year in a congregation. I'm not going to say where. And I'm so excited because I've spent a couple of years gathering all the peace sources from Rabbinic Judaism, and I was going to do my dissertation on it, as a matter of fact, at one point. And I'm getting up there and I'm showing the texts from the rabbis because I figured if I have enough texts, then I'm going to change Jewish people, you know. And I get up there and I'm talking, and there's this old Israeli professor, very accomplished, in the audience, sitting next to his very old wife. Speaking very loudly, because old people are a little harder hearing. And he turns to his wife while I'm talking about love and Judaism and different texts, and I'm proving it, you know. Avostar Abnasan here, Midrash Tanchuma there. He says, he sounds like a Christian. And that was a moment of revelation for me. I said, oh my God. One text after another, and that's Christian. Because for him, post-Holocaust constructs of a modern Jew, that any kind of pro-social feelings like that, it's Christianity. And Judaism is something else. So that's a construct of his brain that he's decided on and that history told him. But it's just a construct. It's the opposite of Lutzato. It's the opposite of Hillel HaZokeh. The opposite of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. But it's his choice. But what you say, what you can do, you can have a different choice. You're the one in charge of your brain. You're the one that is in charge of what you call Torah Judaism. And you can stick by it. You know that every single cab driver, if you ever ask the average Muslim in Egypt or other places, and you get into a cab, and you say to them, what's your favorite verse? You would not believe how many of them say, Allah made us all different in order that we should become to know each other. That verse has had more of an impact on the Muslim world. People mostly know one verse in their religion. Most people on the planet know one verse. And the truth is, it gives them some freedom. Because out of that verse, they decide what is God for them. What is religion? What is ethics? Now, it's true. There's another verse that if you see a Jew under a rock, you know, or look under the rock and kill that Jew too, or whatever angry text that was, and there's an ISIS person who lives by that text, yes. But the fact is that millions of people live by that other text, and we have to be open to that. But also as religious Jews, we have to realize we are constructing our vision. You can say, yeah, tayag mitzvos. Most of them we can't even do today. In many ways, people choose. So in my generation, when or Emmanuel Jacobovitz, the chief rabbi of England, and the other chief rabbis before him, and people like Lutzato, who taught for 50 years in an Orthodox seminary, he taught every one of his students for 50 years that chemla, chesed, is at the core of Judaism. Other people come along later, and they say no. And they interpret. Do you know that he said in 1842, in an Italian text, he said, love all human beings because every one of them is created in the image of God. And he said it in, he said l'uomini in Italian. It was translated in 1962 in Israel into Hebrew, and it says love all Jews. That translator and that post-Holocaust generation made a choice. In this case, it was a deliberate mistranslation. But it's not the only mistranslation. I can tell you these things go on all the time, what you choose to emphasize. So we have a lot more freedom than we think in a textual and hermeneutic culture. And I think that you have to search where is the essence, and even with high education, to come to the conclusion of where that is. It also involves emunah. Who is God for me? Yeah.
I'm Amalia. Hi. And I'm curious, I feel like we're talking like really big.
Yeah.
And I'm curious when it comes down to that, at the heart of conflict between an individual and another individual, I can be in control as much as I want, and I'm going to just get specific because talking in the vague isn't helpful. Let's say my mother and I have a conflict with each other, as often happens. I can be as calm and as knowing of what I want as possible, but right. That might not change the situation. So I get that we're in charge of our own brains and our own hearts and our own minds, but how can we shift what happens between two people?
Correct. Exactly. So
there's and throw an identity, large group conflicts as well.
Yeah.
Right.
We're already out.
Sure. I'm thinking building out.
Right. Yeah, but no, so that's an excellent point, and what I argue in this book is that what I'm looking for is a transformation of the individual to make sure that as much as possible the individual or one party to the conflict is in charge of making themselves the best possible in an adversarial situation. That doesn't mean there's an automaticity to that in terms of conflict resolution. What most of conflict resolution is focused on is dialogue and negotiation and visioning. I've noticed that so many of those later processes of negotiations, of visioning, of plans, were actually screwed up by the earlier parts of self-examination that weren't there. Okay? I had very specific... I still don't understand why I was so beloved in Syria. I was Jewish, I was a rabbi, there was a whole system. I've had Syrian students who went into crisis because they went to the Holocaust Museum and they were taught that there was no Holocaust. Why the heck was I treated the way I was treated in Syria? Why can I go through the Dahesha refugee camp without a gun? And how do I survive? I don't know. I've sat across from ISIS. ISIS was in the hotel near me. I was terrified. So why aren't they killing me? So there's something about your personal behavior that matters a great deal about the energy that's produced around you. Why there are sheikhs that I work with, Sufi sheikhs, and Jews just melt. You know, I'll never forget a Sufi sheikh I worked with here in Jerusalem, and all these Jews were gathered. I think it was Hanukkah time, and they gathered for this event with a Sufi sheikh. And he came into the room, and his face was always so bright with smiling and joy, and it was infectious. And then he said, I want to teach you a song. So we figured we're going to do, how do you say, la ilaha, you know, there's no God but Allah, la, you know, that's the kind of chanting. And he says, Hava, Nagila, Hava. No. And everybody started crying. Why? Because he had embraced the best of the spirit of that song, which is, let's be joyous today. Yeah. And they just started crying. He didn't even have to do it. Did he have to negotiate after that? Two states, one state? It's all way down there. Because he had already established the love that would be necessary for the next steps of rational discourse. But he wouldn't be in charge of rational discourse. He wasn't good at that. He was establishing the atmosphere. And I can tell you that a lot of our best work was establishing that atmosphere with people, and this is where cognitive dissonance comes in. Do you know cognitive dissonance, what that means? So cognitive dissonance, I've learned from neuroscientists lately that cognitive dissonance is not the right term. It's called surprise. I know, very prosaic. But no, seriously, surprise is something that neuroscientists study. And surprise is something that lights up the brain. Now, that's not all good news, because part of the reason that Trump did so well is because every single moment you were surprised. You always didn't expect what he was going to say. And that turns out to transfix the brain. Hitler was the same. But George Carlin was the same. That it just transfixed you. Every time. You never knew what was going to come out of their mouth. So surprise, people love surprise. Well, it turns out that surprise is also something you can use for peace. And so when the sheikh said, Hava Nagila, people, oh my God. Sufi Palestinian from a village is singing Hava Nagila. And so it just totally blew away their sense of what the world was and made many things possible. So the brain loves that. And it almost destroys hard wiring that is involved in stereotypes and predictability of binary systems of enemies. Okay? And you can do that. And I've done that. And it's magical. I was in Syria, in Damascus, and okay. They already know me. I mean, the intel people actually like me here. Seriously. Ben-Gurion is a different story. They're crazy. But the intel people are much more sophisticated. And I was in Syria, and my Syrian partner tells me that there's a woman across the way sitting on the couch. And she said, you know, her widow was, the Achille Lara, right? So her widow was the one that arranged for the hijacking of the Achille Lara. Her husband. Yeah. So I started shaking. I'm in this party. These parties were always scary because there was always some criminal in the room. It's Damascus. There's a lot of nice people, and then there's always a criminal element. And I walked over to her, and I extended my hand, and I said, very nice to meet you. And her eyes lit up. And she said, oh, I know of your work, and I only want peace, and I want to work with peace, and I want to help you. She wrote a book about her husband and also why she's for peace. So it wasn't just bullshit. She published a book on where the future should go. So These kind of things, these surprises, they change people. They move people. Yeah.
I'm Jake. So I did my degrees in psychology and philosophy, mainly psychology, and I did a lot of work on intergroup contact, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. But I've since found coming here and having conversations with people that even though the data in that is very promising in terms of reducing prejudice and stuff, it almost lacks heart and it lacks the compassion. And I'm wondering if you see the synthesis of this, the psychological research as the rational with the Jewish mysticism stuff bringing the compassion, and you need one with the other, and whether psychology is completely devoid of.
So there's a tremendous one of the interesting, and this is gonna you may disagree with this, and it's okay if you disagree. But as an analyst has been involved with people from so many different violent conflicts and so many genocides, I'm surprised by how few people die here. Okay, I have to say that. In other words, I work with Rwandans who lost 800,000 people in a matter of 3 months, one of the quickest genocides in history. Even the genocide experts didn't understand how it was possible. I don't know why in Belfast and here there hasn't been the level of killing, quick killing. I believe that the contacts in Belfast over 30 years, intensive Protestant-Catholic engagement creatively, as much as it was totally frustrating, it was keeping the lid on worse instincts. And similar here. So the contact hypothesis is very frustrating hypothesis. Gordon Allport, etc. There's good and worse. There's some that's really bad. I'll never forget sitting in a room with a bunch of Palestinians and Israelis a long time ago in the 80s. I'm a 20-year-old Chinook, and oh, sorry, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 20 years old, and I'm looking at this, and the moderator on peace gets up there and says, "I'm going to say a word, and then I want you people to react to it." You remember the word association, psychologist, 1948.
Yeah.
And so you go around, and the women really did well. You know, they tried to focus on their emotions and things that happened, and they were sad and they were happy. The men, it was unbelievable. There are no Palestinians. There were none here, and everybody's denying the existence of the other. So it was a disaster, right? So that's contact hypothesis. No, it was a bastardization of contact hypothesis. If contact goes back to Martin Buber, contact was supposed to be deep IU transformation. And some programs are better at that, and some programs are worse. Some programs sit and you do text study between Muslim Christians and Jews, and you do contact on ritual purity in the three religions, and then people get friendly, and then they talk, and then they ask about their children. That's contact. If they go to each other's houses and they even sleep over, wow. I have to write a book someday on sleeping in the enemy's house as the transformational moment, because around the world, from Nigeria to other places, when you sleep in the house of somebody who could kill you, you pass over a kind of boundary that I don't understand. But there's a level of trust that changes you. And this happens with sleepovers. When with groups that are doing sleepovers, it's very different than going there and negotiating at a table like this. That's not contact. That's a fight. That's like an organized fight. Camp David is an organized fight. And the difference between what Rabbi Froman did with Arafat versus what Barak did with Arafat is like, it's two different plans. They're both contact technically, but not. One was just a war. And Arafat's great at hurting people too. You know, we have no illusions about how capable he was. But to us, to admit that the Kotel was holy to Jews and to Palestinians or Muslims, and then to tell Barak that it's never been a Jewish holy place to his face, what's the difference? So he knew how to weaponize. And he also knew how to open up. But it took a lot of skill that Arafat certainly doesn't have to try to open up. And he's, you know, he was the worst case. But I'm talking about people to people much easier than dealing with Camp David, is that it really is up to us how that contact proceeds, how disciplined we are. And again, going back to your question, you cannot control the other, especially the tragedy of proxy warfare. There are many things that go on in this region that are way beyond anybody's control. Okay, there's large forces at work that are keeping Sunni Wahhabi forces well-armed to the teeth with massive weapon systems and not reconciling with Iran, and therefore the whole area being a battleground. There's large forces at work here between Russia and the rest of the world in terms of their base, and many people are sacrificed. You can't change that by being, you know, personally pious. But you can undermine a lot of the dynamic of how they're dividing people by greater personal discipline. And I've done this with peace partners. And we've done it on television, and millions of people have seen that. So it does have an impact, but it's going to take a lot more of us to evolve in a mature way. And then there are third parties. There are many third parties. There are wonderful third parties in Europe, but there are others that are just filled with anger. Some of them are angry. Some, you know, a lot of Christians are just here to get Jews to kill Palestinians to bring the second coming. And then there are other Christians who are just here to tell Jews how bad they are. And, you know, that's not helps. Neither one of those helps. It's the compassionate mediators, like Father Macaulay, but there were extraordinary Catholic intermediaries that helped both sides look at each other, talk to each other, care about each other. So there's many different models of how to do this. So I think contact hypothesis is on the right path. It certainly has lessened killing, but it has a long way to go to be perfected. And some people are just doing better at it than others, you know.
I'm afraid we're out of
time.
But I want to thank you very, very much for coming and sharing some glimpses of some thoughts. I invite everyone to be able to go deeper in with the book. We'll have a copy or two in the Beit Midrash, hopefully. We have a little section of your books. And also invite anyone who's interested in continuing this conversation, expanding it, kind of going deeper, meeting other people that are involved in different areas of conflict resolution, whether it be interpersonal, intergroup, identity conflict, to join me second semester in our track. Good. And
friend me on Facebook if you like. Also friend the public page I have on Moving Humanity Forward. And also this is available on Kindle for $4. I made it that I self-published in order to make it available to people widely. And you know, keep talking to me about issues that you're involved in. I really want to hear.
We did not mention that you are a professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University with an MA and PhD program.
Yes. And a competing master's to Daniel. I'm a senior professor. I'm like at the highest level. It's where they put you before you jump off a cliff. But I'd love you to come to the master's program. And if you have undergraduates who want to, it's a great undergraduate program in conflict resolution. Very high level. Because we want to get many more people around the world into this field from many different cultures. Because it's really having an effect. It's increasing a lot of emotional intelligence in a wide variety. I mean, you're looking at a guy that has taught people from Syrian intelligence and American intelligence, and both of them are transformed by thinking about these things this way. So, you know, there's a lot of ways that we can help. Okay.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.